The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or a comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. And now, here are Dave, Jeff, and another amazing guest on the Vet Tech Cafe. Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Vet Tech Cafe. We hope you enjoyed our last episode with Liz Houston, and we hope to have her back on the show real soon because she's got a lot of other really great projects going on that we'd like to talk more in depth about. Speaking of Liz, Dave, I know you saw she shared on Facebook a couple of abstracts that were presented at IVEX, the International Veterinary and Emergency and Critical Care Symposium in Washington, D.C. this year. And these abstracts talked about burnout syndrome with job-related risk factors in veterinary yes. technicians. And the other one looked at more specifically like caregiver to patient ratios as they relate to major medical errors and that kind of thing. And I think the really cool thing about this is that they the first study, it came from three academic institutions and a multi-specialty referral center in Boston. It came from University of Cornell, University of Florida, and the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and then Angel Medical Center in Boston. And the other one had all of those except University of Florida. I don't know. I think as veterinary technicians, we've known a lot of what is described in these abstracts for a while, but now we have some like really cool concrete evidence. What do you think?
Well, as I was reading through those, I was like reading through and looking at all the results. I'm like, yep, exactly. So basically what they had said was that burnout for technicians, which is, you know, something that we really want to talk about here, is that it's a real thing and it happens. And a lot of it is closely related to our caregiver to patient ratio. And, you know, I've been through this in my career, and I'm sure you have as well, where you've got an ICU full of patients, you're kind of overwhelmed. You don't have enough time in the day to take care of all eight patients that are in your charge. I believe it said that the ratio was greater than four.
Mm-hmm. Four to one.
Led to worse outcomes, like more medical errors,
right.
More burnout, more compassion fatigue, more just overall, not bad patient care, but poor outcomes in patient care because, you know, we get stressed and
right.
it's really hard to deal with all that. So it, like you said, it's not something that was groundbreaking to us. It's just now there's actually a study on it and we have it on paper and it's been investigated. So hopefully that'll be something that we can get through in our careers and make some changes to make our careers a little bit better, a little bit easier.
Yeah. You know, it's hard when you have, you know, an ICU of in the neighborhood of 20, 25 patients plus, and maybe three people. And that ratio starts to get to 8 to 1, 10 to 1, 12 to 1. You know, I think in ICU setting, one thing that really sets some technicians apart from others is like the ability to critically think and, look at your, you look at your patient, look at the trend and so on and so forth. And when you start to get to that number of patients, you kind of have to become less of a critical thinker and more of a box checker. And then you're relying on somebody else to have entered the right boxes in for somebody else to check. And that whole second study, what I'm guessing based on the results are going to look at is all of those things in major medical errors. And I think the number was a greater than 60% increase when that ratio is exceeded. So really, I'm so excited to read those when they are actually published and see what all comes out of that. And I hope that, you know, maybe that'll lead to more research and hopefully it can be a bit of a game changer. Because I think that's like you said, that's something that we've known for a long, long time. But now actually having some documented evidence of that might help turn the tide a little bit. And I think it's so fitting, you know, because today on the show, we have a certified veterinary practice manager, a CVPM, and I look forward to getting his insight on it from his end of things. You know, if can he use that, you know, to help with scheduling and staffing and so on and so forth. So I guess that'll kind of lead us into who we have today. So very excited about today's guest. I know you are too. So we have David Liss coming by the cafe today. David has an incredibly rich and diverse background in the field of veterinary technology. As we all know, he's a RVT, a registered veterinary technician in California. He holds an associate degree in veterinary technology, a bachelor's in sociology, and a master's degree in biomedical science.
He just loves to go to school.
He does. He's double board certified as a veterinary technician specialist in small animal internal medicine and emergency and critical care. He also has his CVPM, his certified veterinary practice manager credential, and professional in human resources, a PHR certificate. He's been technician manager at two different 24-hour referral centers in Los Angeles. Has contributed to numerous texts, lectured at seemingly every conference under the sun. One veterinary technician educator of the year.
If you go to a conference, you're guaranteed to see
it. Right, hopefully. I mean, you know, that's he's one of those that is a big draw for everybody. And is currently the director of operations for AmeriVet in Los Angeles, and runs his own consulting business, which we should mention, veterinary training and consulting. And also, I think is super cool, is the founder of the very popular Facebook group called ER Vet Tech Rounds, which is now over 20,000 members strong. And I think we were looking at this earlier, it was formed in 2012, so a little over 7 years now. So
right when we were starting the study.
So anyway, we're so happy to have him here today. David Liss, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe.
Well, hey guys, how are you?
Good, how are you doing today?
Good, thanks Jeff and Dave, this is cool. I'm glad just to have a cup of coffee and sit down and chat with you guys.
So let's get you a cup of coffee. How would you take your cup of coffee or your caffeinated beverage of choice?
Oh, let's see. It's about 5:30 my time. I've got to power through another 6 or 7 hours of work. I will do a double blonde espresso with half and half, two Splendas, and a splash of hazelnut.
Wow, that's very specific.
Can you tell I drink just a little coffee?
Just a little bit, yeah.
You'll probably be disappointed to know that I'm drinking just peppermint-flavored coffee right now.
I
drink it black. I like strong coffee, but you know, it's wintertime here, and
Dave,
I'm drinking it out of my Santa mug, so here we are.
Dave, how do you even let him on the show, man?
this is the first I'm hearing of this. I believe I was sold a bill of goods.
So David, let's start off with your path from before you became a veterinary technician. Like, why did you want to do that? And then you've done so much in a relatively short period of time. So, you know, what kind of led you to some of those major career milestones that kind of made you want to do more and more? And how'd you get to where you are?
Career trajectory, I think, started in high school. I was kind of interested in being a human doctor, actually, but from watching too much TV. And I decided to volunteer at my local vet clinic. I just thought, oh, you know, I can't really see myself doing a hospital volunteer thing right now, so maybe I'll just go check that out. And I remember walking in on the first day, and, you know, there was this dog in the back that I remember just wandering in, and the vet had an x-ray up and shows me that the dog had a pneumothorax and he was hit by a car. And I have to say, looking back on it, there was no catheter, there was no oxygen, there was no chest tap. However, I remembered that the word pneumothorax had come up on, you know, the TV multiple times, and I'm like, whoa, that's a collapsed lung. You know, from there, realized like, okay, animals get the same things as humans, okay. And then, you know, started working in vet clinics in high school and kind of became, you know, on the job trained as a tech and just kind of fell into the career, you know, and you start to kind of carve a path for yourself and, you know, enjoy the people you work with and enjoy the industry. And so I went to college. I was actually going to, you know, think about being a veterinarian, and I went to college and did all that stuff, but I was working as a tech full time and going to school. And I ended up finishing college and wanted to get my RBT license. So I did the alternate route, which is here in California. It's a way to get your license by doing a small set of credentialed technician classes that then apply to the boards, but you don't do a full degree. And I finished college and I had my RVT and I was feeling legit and I was applying to vet school and didn't get in. I know, God forbid, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I look back and I just go, it was just another path that opened up, right? And so I just kind of took a really hard look and I thought, you know, do I want to suck it up and do I want to reapply or do I want to kind of roll with the punches? I was making, you know, pretty good money and enjoying my shift work and working in an ICU. And I just said, you know what, let's just live life and stay in the moment and you know, and ride this thing out as far as it can go. So I just kind of threw myself whole hog into veterinary nursing and within the next year had my VTS in emergency critical care. And I was the supervisor of, you know, a group of technicians. And then I think really the next 10 or so years of my life started to pan out because I started to realize that I really enjoyed leadership and working with teams and training and kind of all of that that came along with that piece. And I realized, you know, I enjoy working with animals, but I'm not totally that kind of stereotypical introvert, 100% introvert. Like I'm an extroverted introvert, but like I really enjoyed working with the staff and the teams and teaching and training. And I thought, oh, okay. So I kind of moved, you know, that direction and started to split time between the floor and supervising, managing, and left that one practice and went to do a management in another practice, and then ended up falling into the job as a director of a vet tech program for a few years. And again, along this whole line. And so then I went back into being the manager of a 24-hour facility, and, you know, now I'm the director of operations for a group of vet hospitals. So, you know, I still really rely on my technician background, and I really look at what I do as a manager, you know, in leadership, and they're not really mutually exclusive. I think sometimes you have managers that aren't leaders and leaders that aren't managers. But for me, I think that at least in the way our industry is going, that in order to lead in the veterinary hospital, you kind of have to be a manager, at least from what I said. I mean, it's not 100% true, but from where I sit. And then, but then the vice versa thing is, you know, if you manage and you're not leading a vet hospital, as we were going to probably talk about a little later, you know, the human capital element of our industry is so big. I mean, the people are such a huge part of how we drive practices and the teams and everything. So you can't treat them like cogs in a wheel, you know. And so you have to, in my opinion, be a leader. And if you're not a great leader as a manager, you need to learn some leadership skills. And I learned the management stuff along the way, and I'm still learning a lot, you know, in that regard. But I don't think they go hand in hand. We can talk all day about a spreadsheet and numbers, but you know, you got to lead and manage those people. So that's kind of where I ended up, where I am today.
Okay. So you said you were an alternate route grad in California, and I was as well. Did you find that you had, and for those again that aren't familiar, it's in California, you're able to, instead of doing a full 2-year AVMA accredited program, there's a number of different programs out there, but you can do an abbreviated program where you do have a given number of in-classroom hours, but not full degree. And then you have also basically like a work externship, if you will, where you have a certain number of in-clinic hours that are required, and then you can sit for the, at the time when I did it, and probably for you as well, it was just the California RVT exam, and now we have adopted the VTNE. But did you find that you had any obstacles as you were setting out on this path that, you know, the alternate route maybe closed doors for you, or doors were closed to you, and you had to go back and get a 2-year degree to do things that you wanted to, or have you been able to do everything you wanted with the alternate route education?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer is that for me, absolutely yes, because when I took the helm as the director of a tech program, the chief operating officer of the college misread the AVMA guidelines and thought that my credentials were sufficient, and they were not. So you have to have the director of a program, and I don't remember exactly the wording, but it's something along the lines of they have to either be a vet that had graduated from an AVMA DVM program, but that's all of them, or a credentialed veterinary technician that has a 2-year AVMA accredited degree or a 4-year, you know, AVMA bachelor's.
Okay.
And so when we looked at my stuff, I went, no, I have a bachelor's degree, but it's not in vet tech and I don't have the AVMA degree. And so as we went through the accreditation process, the school said, okay, you know, here's your lead time to when we would vote on the accreditation status. And then here's the period after the vote when we would have some leeway, but you have to have your degree by X date. And so I did the Penn Foster program. I hopped right on and I begged and pleaded with them, and they let me move through the didactic really quickly. But I had to do every single course. I had to pass every single course. I did get a couple of classes waived just for some undergrad stuff. And I had to do all the skills and document and take pictures. And Liz can tell you, I mean, she helped me with some of the large animal stuff when I went up to hang with her in NorCal. So yeah, I had to get my 2-year degree for that. Other than that, though, and I'm not knocking the 2-year degrees, I absolutely believe in them, but not really. I mean, I think the industry, I think, still really just looks at the credential and says, are you RVT, CBT, and that's, you know, what really matters. But yeah, for those that are listening that have an alternate route or have done any kind of a grandfather program and really want to go into teaching or see themselves being the director or assistant director or something of a program, go do your 2-year degree and do it online or something, because you're going to need it. It's a non-negotiable for the AVMA.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I'm in the teaching field now myself, and I also went alternative route, and I didn't do that. The program that you guys were talking about, I basically was allowed to take the VT&E if I drove down to Delaware to go take it. so for a couple of years while I was feeling smart, I decided I would be an LVT and a CVT. I had an LVT in Delaware, even though I'd been in Delaware for exactly 24 hours. But now that I'm in the teaching field, I'm in that same situation where if I want to become the program director, which, I mean, mm-hmm. I've only been there for, what, 6-7 weeks now? I don't have aspirations to become the director just yet. But if I do want to do that, that is something that I'll have to do as well.
Yeah.
So speaking about education, you've gone through and gotten a couple master's degrees. So what really prompted you to go and do that?
That's a great question. I think, so having been in the veterinary education space, when I was in that space, I thought that was going to kind of be it. That was going to be the forever job for me. And yeah. So working with the group of veterinary technician educators that are in this country, and there's a great network of them. Many, many of them have master's degrees. And, you know, it also helps you within the, whether you're at a community college or a private four-year or for-profit, whatever it is, it helps open up some doors if you wanted to move on to be, you know, dean of a section or, you know, campus president or whatever it is. So it was kind of like a career move, you know, to jump forward. And I looked at some masters, you know, in education and some other stuff. And I just decided this biomedical science degree out of the University of Missouri popped up. So it's basically a master's degree run out of the veterinary school online. So it's kind of like, you know, Davis has the MPVM master's, right. And I think it's veterinary preventative medicine. It's kind of the same idea. So it's the veterinary school at Missouri, at Mizzou, runs a post-bac graduate level degree. And so it's in biomedical science, and they just say that it has a veterinary emphasis. And so when I looked at the course list, I thought, oh, this is pretty cool. And it's fairly affordable tuition. I don't think they actually have a difference between in and out of state. At least they didn't when I went. So it was essentially in-state tuition, even though I wasn't a resident. Right. And so it was great. It was 2 years and you do a project. And it's interesting you guys bring up those studies, because my project just got accepted into JAVMA. It's not published yet, but it is going through now. It went through peer review and now been accepted to be reviewed by the editor, and it's on factors that have to do with engagement and job satisfaction amongst a group of veterinary technicians. Mm-hmm. So I've really looked at kind of organizational development, organizational psychology, stuff that kind of makes workers tick, and I say workers because that's the general term, but like veterinary technicians or staff or, you know, employees, what really makes them tick, because there's so much good literature out there that really supports that productivity, revenue, booming business, kind of whatever you want to think about, you know, and of course on the nursing side, it would be patient care and job satisfaction are really driven from those core things, being satisfied and being engaged at work. And so if you think about it on kind of the massive scale, it would be, how do you get workers, you know, looking at their jobs and satisfied and want to come to work, and that produces more output or revenue for a company. And I think in the veterinary space, you know, the metric that the study authors of the stuff you guys mentioned, their outcome was patient care, right? Different metrics, right, but right. Patient care. And so to me, I think that's pretty fascinating to figure out, you know, if you fix or if you improve the employee issue, not, I don't want to say problem, but the issue, you get better patient care, you get better, you know, outcomes in that sense. And you can turn it around kind of on the general practice side too, and look at revenue and look at how many dentals they do and how many spays they do. That's all good medicine. And it also is revenue for the practice. So kind of what that course gave me, I mean, there was a lot of science too. I took classes in cytology and toxicology and things that were taught by boarded specialists at the college, but they were teaching them from an academic level, and it wasn't about how to diagnose diseases, it was just the theory. So it was pretty cool. I really, really enjoyed the degree, and it's, you know, it's intense but flexible because it's online, and, you know, I took proctored exams and, you know, the whole bit. So it's definitely something to look into, and you can just really find it on, you know, online.missouri.edu and you know, search for veterinary biomedical science masters.
Huh, that's very interesting. That's super cool.
When I think of David Liss, I always think of him always being a great educator. You have been one of the inspirations for me for being a speaker, because I've gone to a lot of your lectures at IVEX and other conferences, and you can engage an audience on – For example, I saw you give a talk on how to research and basically going through how to do Google searches and searching through different databases, and you were completely engaging. And like somebody said, you really went to that lecture? I'm like, yeah, it's David Liss, of course. So how did you get your speaking career started, and what kind of led you on that path to go on the speaking side?
So I will give you the absolute straight answer of this is I did a case report at IVEX. That was how it all started.
Awesome.
And you know, I have to absolutely thank one of the founders of veterinary emergency critical care nursing, Leslie Carter out of CSU. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I submitted my case report. She accepted it. I was judged by none other than the amazing Ann Wardinger and Nancy Schaffrin.
Oh,
I believe Angel Rivera may have also been on that panel. Talk about being able to get through the gauntlet. Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
And Leslie, you know, gave me some feedback, and I ended up winning the case report thing, which was cool because everybody was amazing. I was like, there's no way. And she invited me to come speak the next year. I think I had two or three talks. You know, she was in every one of my talks. She gave me feedback. And yeah, it was incredible. And then pretty much from there, it kind of spun from like IBEX into Western States, what we all call it. I think it's Western Veterinary Conference is what it's called.
Yeah.
And at that point, when I started to kind of get my chops a little bit, you know, I also thought, hey, maybe this is a career path. And I think they all have been, but it just hasn't. It takes a lot of effort to keep going. And I just sent out a gazillion emails to every vet medical association conference I could think of and sent my resume and started to get a bunch of traction. And then after a couple of years, people start to kind of ask you to speak. You know, they've heard your name or they've seen you or whatever. And so, you know, now I'm kind of in a little bit of a sunset of that phase of my life, which is amazing. I love it. There's so many fantastic speakers out there. And I'm not clinical anymore. So, you know, it doesn't make sense really for me other than maybe at a really academic conference like IBEX or something where I can present information that I'm kind of teaching the audience through. But, you know, I have my stories and my cutesy pictures and all that stuff. But that's, you know, it's 8 to 10 years ago. So I love that I had a really good run. I mean, I've been speaking for about 10 years and now I see the conferences and I go, man, yeah, it's VTSs all over the place. And so it's how awesome. I mean, it feels great for me to look at that and, you know, to think in some way like I paved a little bit of that way, because the way was paved for me too by Nancy and Leslie and Angel and Harold, you know.
Right.
And so so I just, you know, happened to get swept up into that river. And then now my babbling brook has gone off the other direction. I've got you guys, both of you and, you know, so many other colleagues that are. Yeah. That are speaking, and more conferences having tech tracks and veterinary hospitals hosting days where technicians are speaking. So, you know, it's cool. It's really cool to have seen that. Like I think Nancy and Angel talk about where, you know, they were like at almost every conference because it was just like a small group, and it's just gotten bigger each chapter. So yeah, so that's kind of the background on that piece.
Well, and it's also gotten a lot more diverse too. It's like you said, it's not the same small group of people that are speaking at all the conferences.
Yeah.
You go to a conference, you see all new faces and all new speakers that.
Absolutely.
They're all doing really, really well.
Cool. Oh, yeah. And my philosophy, and I think, you know, you probably benefit from it as, you know, people who have sat through my lectures, is I personally and firmly believe you cannot be a boring speaker. That it is unacceptable.
Right.
Like, get off the stage, because, you know, they talk about how the brain only can handle, I think it's like 10 or 12 minutes of information kind of in one spot, and then it resets and has to kind of recharge. And so if you're droning on, I'm sorry, you could have multiple PhDs and be the best person in the world. The problem is none of the people in that audience are going to absorb any of the amazing information you have. So, you know, I was just gifted, I think, having the kind of the gift of speech and the gift of presentation. But if you're not totally awesome, no problem. Go to Toastmasters, get some chops under you about how to present. I've done it. I mean, I you know, learning how to do inflection and speed control and enunciation and how to prepare PowerPoints, all of that stuff was nothing that I had natural talent at. I learned from Nancy. I learned from Leslie. I learned from Andrea Steele. So learn and realize that putting up a chart with 50,000 data points and a tiny little line about what the study said is not going to engage your audience. They're not going to take anything away from it. And that's the point. You do the research in your lab. Be a research scientist. The point of a conference is to give clinical information and tidbits that the audience can take away and use in the clinic. And so, you know, I it's nothing more disheartening to me than to have people that either go to a conference or at a conference I'm at, or they come back from a conference and I say, oh, what did you learn? You know, not much. And I go, what? Like, you just wasted your money, man, you know? Yeah. So anyway, that's probably what you benefited from, because I firmly, firmly believe that. And I tried to live that too. That's where the energy comes from. That's where the delivery comes from, because it's like a personal blow to me if somebody, obviously they have critiques in a lecture, but if after the lecture they go, ugh, I didn't really learn anything, or, oh, you're really boring, I would just, I mean, like, be like, okay, I'm done, I'm out, you know? So that's where that comes from, is this kind of underlying moral piece about, this is how my you know, taking little feedbacks every time I speak and seeing what's working, what's not working, right, playing to the audience. And so that's what you end up with, you know, and I just think that if you're boring, man, get off the stage. And you can quote me on that.
That's sound advice.
You know, you said something in there real quick before I move on to my next question. You said you haven't been on the clinic side or clinical side for, you know, for several years now. Do you miss it at all?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I do. And I think that as human beings and adults, we often think like, oh, you miss it. And it's like, no, I miss it because of what it gave me and who I was on the floor. But I don't see myself going back at this point. And it has nothing to do with the profession itself. It's just, I feel like right now I have other things I need to do for the profession, you know, like, yeah, where I'm at. But yeah, of course I totally miss it. I mean, there is nothing like the feeling of having a bleeding out Yorkie with a torn up neck, and you get that 22 gauge introducer catheter into the jugular, and then you feed that wire, and that dog has a triple lumen in 4 minutes, and that criticalist looks at you like you're freaking magic, and you just handing out ports to all the team. Who wants a port? You want a port? I want a port. Everybody gets a port. You know, there's nothing like that. Or the dog that comes in with a, you know, bone sticking out of its chest and in complete cardiopulmonary rest, and even, I mean, before the recover, you know, initiative, but we just, you know, somebody gets compressions going, the dog gets tubed, you get, you know, fluids, you get pressure on that chest wound, you tap that chest, you slam blood in there, and all of a sudden that dog goes home 3 weeks later. You know, I mean, right, there's just, right, nothing like that.
Yeah.
But it leads us to what, you know, we're probably going to deal with a little bit later, which is, like, you know, with intense highs, right? In a job like that, there have to be intense consequences and lows, and that's, you know, burnout and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm so rusty. Oh my God, I don't know if I could even get a catheter in these days. But that's why, you know, I think as a manager and a leader, you know, veterinary technician teams and staff, you know, they want to feel part of something. And so if you are so above everything that you never, you know, just help out on the floor, but also kind of like, I like to show my humility and say, look, I'm an RVT, I'm a tech, but I'm going to hold for you. Like, I'm, you know, this is beyond what I can do, because I like to give people the ability to be experts in their own area, you know, and I don't like to be the expert of everything. I'm not the expert of everything. So I think it's cool to kind of, you know, be a manager that can then float to the floor, and the techs are like, oh man, you know, this is great. Like, you've got somebody in your corner that gets it, right?
Yeah, right.
So I'm nothing against people who've never had any, you know, medical background as managers, but I would encourage you guys to, you know, get on the floor a little. You know, you don't have to, you're not going to put in catheters. I wouldn't expect you to, and I don't think the techs or anybody wants you to, but just see how your floors run and understand what that's like, you know, because obviously we don't typically go in the room with the doctor. So it's like, where else can you see the medical side? Is be on the floor a little and see how, yeah, that goes, and understand what that's like and what your teams deal with, you know, on a minute to minute, day to day kind of basis.
Well, and when you do that, that gives them the sense of, like you said, that you're in their corner, like, you know what's going on the floor. You're not just somebody that's sitting in an office. You're actually out there, and you know what's going on, and
yeah,
you get that kind of sense of team with them, where they're not feeling like, well, David's not doing his share. Well, he doesn't usually do his share, but yeah, now he's on the floor, and now he's,
yeah,
helping out, yeah, and helping us in the trenches. So that I think that's awesome that you can do that still.
They have a really fancy term for that. It's called management by walking around.
That's awesome. So several years ago, you, David, recruited me to the California RVT Association Board of Directors. You were on that before I was, and then you ultimately, like, transitioned into the AVICT Board, the Academy for Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care Technicians Board, for a little while. Talk a little bit about that and, like, the importance of some of these associations to the technician profession, and kind of help moving things forward.
Sure. Before I started in any of that administrative, not in a bad connotation, but political stuff, you don't have any idea what how that impacts the profession, and having been behind the scenes a little bit, it's really, really interesting. Everything from who is kind of deemed worthy of getting a credential, you know, so there's, like, for example, on the credentialing side, there's a stopgap between on either a voluntary credential like the critical care, you know, VTSs, the NABTS, or on the licensure side, because you have people in place, and CARVDA is like a lobbying group for the Veterinary Medical Board, who's the regulatory side, but like, you have to have that vet tech voice, and they have the CVMA, which is the California Vet Med Association. So they have the veterinary and the vet tech voice that then gets filtered to the regulatory body, who says, oh, well, maybe we should make XYZ a requirement to be a license, or remove a requirement, or add this layer, or everything from what the board does every day is citing people who do bad things with their license. You know, it's that all of those things are such small pieces to this huge puzzle. It's like grains of rice, but absolutely impact the profession, so that, you know, when you look to your right and you look to your left and you've got RVTs or CVTs or LVTs on both sides, that they're of a certain quality. You know, you've got the Veterinary Technician Association in California, CARVTA, that advocates for technician protection of the licensing terms, so that veterinary technicians or assistants that do not have the license are not called the same thing. It's not an offensive move. It's not a judgment. It's just you don't call registered nurses certified nurse assistants. They are registered nurses. There are specific terms. Title protection is the term for it. So they have advocatory bodies that advocate for that. And I'm a huge fan of staff that don't have licenses. I think you guys do an amazing job, but it's different. You know, some people have a license, some people don't. So you've got that piece. You've got association that deal, you know, they deal with education, and they, you know, make sure they host their own conference and they support technicians in the industry. So that's kind of the general side, say, of like CARVTA and CVMA and the Vet Medical Board. On the credentialing side, on the VTS side, it's amazing to think that a group of technicians got together and said, okay, we have a specialty. We only do emergency critical care or oncology or surgery or dentistry, and we want to offer an extended credential to technicians. So they have to set this all up, and it's an organization that has to run. So it collects money. It has to decide what to do with that money. It has to create rules and policies and uphold those policies, and then figure out how all that gets given back to the members. And so being anything from a member at large, which is kind of the kind of lowest piece on the totem pole, where you're supporting, they sometimes call them directors, where you're supporting the organization and supporting different officers, all the way up into being a president, past president, treasurer, secretary, any officer, even to some of these organizations that have paid staff members, like a CEO or an administrative executive, you know, or executive secretary, where they're paid positions that you're not actually then in the group, but you do administrative stuff to support it. So, you know, all of us that have had either gotten a BTS, had a pet that has been worked on by a VTS, or, you know, has gotten any education in the emergency critical care sector, has benefited from this group. And then if you're a consumer, if you bring in your pet and you've been worked on by an RVT, the Veterinary Medical Board, the California Vet Med Association, and the California RVT Association have impacted you. You know, so that's what these organizations do. And it's and there's, of course, NAVT as well, the National Association for Vet Techs in America. You know, that's what these organizations do. And so getting to be a part of that was really fascinating. And I think in a way may have stimulated some of my interest in administrative, managerial type of work. So yeah, it's a fun ride. I really suggest anybody that's interested in advocacy work, speaking up about the profession and making a difference that is really statewide or national or even global, look into your state association, credentialing body, look at obtaining a VTS and then being a part of that VTS's academy's administration. It's really, really, really worth it. You know, you have zero regrets and only the best memories of all that work that I did.
Super cool. Yeah, that's oftentimes, you know, a lot of people don't really understand or know much about what goes on behind the scenes at a lot of those meetings, but there's so much important work that is done, you know, that sets the tone. And for everything that we do, it's really, really something else. You mentioned a couple times in there education, and you obviously spent some time as a program director for an AVMA accredited program. What, if you could, not that you have to narrow it down, but what is like one major challenge that you see facing like vet tech education?
Yeah, I need to know that because I'm a teacher now.
Oh, man. You know, it's tough. I think that we're kind of, you know, the profession is in a struggle right now. And it's not a bad thing. It's a really good thing. And it's going to be a struggle for a long, long, long time. But it's a struggle on multiple fronts. And it has to, like, really do with veterinary technicians. There's a veterinarian struggle, too. But this is not the Vet Cafe. This is the Vet Tech Cafe. So the Vet Tech struggle is every practice needs and wants a technician that can walk in the door and first of all has the right attitude. They're a team player, they're, you know, engaged, they're also you know, a people pleaser in the sense that they kind of keep up with their doctor and get stuff done, but they also need to have a good base of knowledge. And it's, you know, and I, when I say common sense, it's not common sense like don't put your foot and trip, but common sense like when you pull up, you know, a syringe, you put the bevel up, or you draw to the, you know, the medical common sense, the medical base. You know, if the dog is blood pressure's plummeting under anesthesia, you tell the doctor and you turn down the ISO, turn up the fluids, blah, blah, blah. You know, you've got all that stuff going on. And that's not what vet tech schools do. That is not who we produce. We produce entry-level technicians. So you have the profession saying, we need somebody that has 15 years of experience to run in and walk in and run the show. You've got vet tech schools saying, we've seen them competently place a catheter, competently intubate, but and maybe on paper or in the clinic troubleshoot an anesthesia situation, but not with the level of pressure of a job and money involved and a doctor screaming at you and a spay bleeding out. You know, that's not what we produce. Yeah. And so then the profession goes, well, we don't want that. And the vet tech schools say, but you have to because we're pumping out these students. So there's this really big divide that we need to start bridging, and we need to start hiring new grads, mentoring and training them. That's the biggest thing. But stop blaming the schools for producing graduates that are not clinically proficient. Well, they are, but they are at an entry level. They're not, you know, these are not VTS training academies. Right. So that's one piece. And the other piece of it is that with the entrance of for-profit schools into the sector, there's nothing wrong with that. They operate from a business model of, you know, having to get in students to get tuition to pay for the care. I mean the schooling, because it's not funded by any third party. So they have to maintain quotas and levels of students and budgets that will keep them in business, basically. So the problem, though, is that there isn't as much infrastructure to really support that. There aren't, you know, a million clinics within a 2-mile radius to give every student an externship. There aren't, there isn't budgets for, you know, $250,000 to $300,000 for a build out of a teaching facility. And so the vet tech schools are doing what they can to train these students, but then the industry has to start saying, great, and we're going to hire new grads, and we're going to take them, you know, the next step. So I think that both sides, I think on the education side, I think that all schools need to have unbendable limits of who they accept and how they screen, and to make sure without a measure of a doubt that the student that graduates from a vet tech program is competent and proficient. They don't have to be, you know, excelling, but they can't be subpar and sneak by. We have to make sure that happens. And then on the industry side, we got to get better at not making new grad be a bad word, because it really is at anybody's mouth, whether it's vet or vet tech. And so I think that the gap there is to start realizing, and this is, again, going to lead into the kind of penultimate topic of tonight, is that we have this industry of insane type A people, perfectionist people, and life and workers and employees and everything is really more of a bell curve. You've really got more of a normal distribution. So you're going to have staff that are on one end of the spectrum that maybe come in, do their job, clock in and go home, but can place a catheter, can draw blood, can put in charges correctly, and they're going to be that kind of technician. And then you're going to have a group that are, you know, a very small group that are unacceptable, and we get rid of them, or we don't hire them, or we, you know, we don't continue them in our profession. But not everybody exists to the far right that's the top 5% of the industry, where they are that excellent crazy superstar. That's not what life is, and that's not what what education is. So we have to start working, I think, in the middle of the bell curve and deciding as clinics, because we're still mostly an industry of non-consolidated clinics, saying these are the people that I have in my hospital. Here's my superstar techs and my non-superstar techs, but these are my solid good employees. and letting that be an okay standard. Because, you know, I dealt with this as a director all the time, where I'd have a student who showed up to an internship, missed a couple catheters, got a few in, and they would get marked horribly awful. And I would call and kind of try to figure out what's going on. They go, well, she just didn't run around and she wasn't super into everything. You know, it was that type A piece. And I go, well, I'm really sorry about that. You know, she's got two kids and she's struggling to make ends meet, and she got her car repossessed last month and she's just trying to get, you know, those types of stories that all of us have heard and dealt with. And so, you know, where I think we need to really, really work better as a profession is start to build that gap and bridge that divide between education and the industry, and say schools are not meant to produce, you know, veterinarians that can do GDVs or vet techs that can do triple lumens. That's not their job. So if we give them the cold shoulder and we don't really embrace them as new grads and mentor them and train them up to be the most amazing technicians we want to see in them, then we're going to continue to see what we are, which is a lot of techs in the industry leaving because there's nobody to replace them, and new grads that very rapidly leave the profession and go on and do other things because they're not met with open arms, you know? So I think that's kind of the biggest challenge that I think we as an industry need to move forward to. And it's on both sides. I think the for-profit schools need to make sure that they're doing everything by the letter of the law and they're producing a really, really solid student. But then on the industry side, we have to start realizing that if a vet tech school, let's say it graduates, I don't know, 50 you know, students a year, graduates a year, not all 50 of them are going to be VTSE CCs. You know, you're going to have 35 that are just averagey, five-ish that are not great, and 5 to 10 that are going to be superstars. And so that's the nature of the beast. And I think that's one of the biggest things that you know, we need to start really tackling. I saw this when I was a director and I was working with students, and they would, you know, I'd be like, man, this student, God, they're just driving me crazy. There's so much potential. And I had to tell myself, I'm going to do my job. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to work for them. But if they get a C+ on a test, is that passing? Yeah, moving on to the next course, because they're not going to be the insane driven type A person that I might be. And that's okay. It's really okay. Not below standard, right? That's not. But like acceptable and proficient are okay terms to use when we're talking about students, you know, and then they go into the profession and then we go, my God, they're such a horrible employee. Well, they show up on time. You know, they're not the one that's going to help you out in a bind and surgery, but they can put in charges and place catheters and draw blood and set up fluids and write on treatments. That's their job, you know, and that's being a vet tech at some practices. So, so that's kind of my take.
You just blew my mind right there. I've yeah. I've been a full-time teacher for, like I said, about 7 weeks now. And, you know, I got into teaching because I said I want to give back and I want to produce great techs, and not taking into account that it's okay to produce okay techs, because I come from the VTS background, where I want to produce the best, and not realizing that that's not necessarily what the industry needs right now. They need technicians that are, like you said, that are, for lack of a better term, just okay, that can actually show up on time and have a good attitude and be able to place catheters sometimes. You know, that's just kind of changed everything that I've thought about these last 7 weeks, yeah. Of what I... Because my answer was going to be, we're not pumping out technicians with enough skills, where, like you said, I don't need to pump out technicians with fantastic skills. I need to pump out technicians that are going to be able to go on and get better. Me teaching them is not the end of their education. Not that I thought that I was the end of their education, but realizing that once they go beyond me, they're still going to learn. Because, I mean, you, me, and Jeff did that, right? We went on beyond learning, right? and got better. So yeah, that. That was very insightful. I've learned a lot.
The industry
today
needs technicians, and so the way that the profession is going to get better is, as we know, as we flood the market with more credentialed technicians to make that, you know, mean something and have more meat behind it. And you got to do that in volume, because there's so many jobs open out there. The employment unemployment is so low that these candidates have 5 to 10 jobs in a 50-mile radius, you know, to pick from. Right. So I'm not advocating for pumping out substandard technicians, right? You know, and then that's what I think a lot of times that for-profits are kind of saddled with is, well, this you know, this student missed a catheter, so they're so terrible. What were they doing? Well, they were learning about parasites. They were taking x-rays. They were learning how to scale dentals. Yeah, they missed a catheter on their first day. Get over it. That's okay. Take them under your wing and train them. We didn't have time to give them 50 catheters to get proficient at.
Right.
So, you know, that's how we're going to make the profession better, is getting credentialed techs out there, you know, and again, yes, I'm not advocating for somebody who, you know, misdoses drugs because they were passed through a math exam because the school looked the other way. That's not what I'm advocating. Right. But if they can calculate mg to kg and then to mil and can administer an injection IV and monitor a patient and intubate them, That's your technician level one, you know, and then you move up from there.
Yeah. So changing gears into your shift to clinical practice to management. So what led to that? I know we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but describe what the CVPM process is and what led you to that.
Oh, sure. So I think it just really goes back to, you know, me wanting to lead. And to me, I think there's lots of ways to be a leader, but I think for me, in order to be a leader, you know, you have to be in the driver's seat of the practice. And the driver's seat is somebody who knows the cash flow of the practice, the budgets, where the money's coming from, how it's transferred, who's being hired, what the laws are that you, you know, should or shouldn't be breaking, or shouldn't be breaking, you know. And that piece, you know, the regulatory side, are the clients happy and what everything goes in the client satisfaction. So, that's running a great business, and that's a huge part of it. But again, in order to drive a practice and to really lead a practice and charge them into the, you know, into the fray of such a competitive industry that we are, you know, arena that we have now, that those management skills come into play. So the CVPM is like very similar to a VTS in the sense that it's an advanced credential, certified veterinary practice manager. It's overseen by the Veterinary Hospital Management Association, that, by the way, is an amazing, amazing organization. They do benchmarking studies. They have some of the earliest studies that we have in technician and vet and assistant pay scales and compensation strategies and fee setting stuff. I mean, it's an amazing organization, super, super brilliant brain trust, more on the management side. But they have everything from fancy lectures on accounting to lectures on organizational development and HR and you know, leadership and all that stuff. So the CVPM is a little different, though. You do have to have years of experience in a variety of different job titles, whether it's, you know, supervisor, manager, whatever. You have to have some college level courses in management. So I took business law, accounting, and I forgot the last one. So you have to have actually college level courses. So most people go online, do online, but you have to, like, at a community college. So that's kind of cool. You have to take semester long courses. So the CVPM is over a 2-year process to go through. You have to, there's a skills list, quote unquote, of different areas of the practice you've been involved in that a manager or your boss has to sign off on. You have to take a bunch of CE, just like a VTS, and then you sit an exam, credentialed standardized exam. So all of those pieces go into that as well. So it's got the same level of designation as a veterinary technician specialist. It's just specific to veterinary management.
What type of skills did you have to have?
So you have to have managed. So there's just like there is in the VTS side, right. There's domains for the CVPM. So forgive me, I'm not a CVPM expert, but I believe it's marketing, finance, inventory, let's say legal, ethical. Those are kind of the domain areas. So for example, you had to have managed, you know, an inventory system and calculated a bunch of inventory ratios and run different reports and things like that, and kind of had that piece managed. Marketing, you had to have run some campaigns and launched some social, you know, manage social media stuff and have been able to look at some ROI on marketing. Finances, you had to be proficient in, you know, reading a profit and loss statement and having a, you know, discussion with, you know, an owner about finances and prepared a budget for the practice and those kinds of things. So it's like managerial skills. And, you know, we could probably spend a whole hour on those too, but a lot of, you know, you had to be familiar with hiring, you know, labor laws and having had been directly involved with, you know, recruiting and hiring of staff. So, you know, it's kind of like an MBA really, like in veterinary management, essentially, when you're talking about, you know, the level of which you're going through these different areas of expertise really in a veterinary practice.
Mm. One thing I would be curious about, so I find in this profession, and maybe you guys have had some experience with this as well, it seems like in a clinic setting, somebody that gets promoted to, say, supervisor is, you know, somebody that's been on the floor for a long time, and then they kind of start with that position, they start doing some inventory, and they might start doing some budgeting, and they might start doing, you know, hiring and firing, and, you know, some of start taking on some of those roles without really ever getting any formal training to do so. They basically were kind of defaulted into that role because they've been in that clinic for a little while, and maybe they have some innate knowledge of how that clinic runs. And thinking about an actual CVPM type program and credential, the difference would be huge. I mean, doing what you're doing now for the company that you're doing it for, the clinics you're working for, could you even imagine trying to fulfill that role without all the training that you've had?
No, absolutely not. Not in a million years.
And it's crazy because it happens. I mean, in everywhere.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're referring to. And there's nothing wrong with that, but I think that's, it's an interesting thought process for an owner or a, administrator, whoever makes that decision, is kind of like, well, I think they'd be great at it, so I think I'm just going to have them try out. And there's so many questions that I have. One is, did they want to do it? And two, did they want to do it for the right reasons? Did they want the ego trip of I'm the head tech and I walk around this place like I own it? Or did they go, I'm moving into a new position with new responsibilities and I'm gonna learn through this? And maybe they didn't have any of those skills because nobody helped them see that they're gonna struggle in this new position as well. The other thing that I have and I just think about is like, is that the right person and is that the right seat? And that's a term used in a lot of different management stuff. Yeah. But there's a great book called Traction, Gino Wickman book, and he talks about having the right people in the right seats. And that's such a you can boil down to any bad hiring or staff position: is there the wrong person in the wrong seat? Right. And there's a lot of reasons why that is. But think about it. So is that person the right person? Are they the ones that, the staff look to for training and mentoring, that they have the respect of the staff, they have the command of communicating with an employee in a crisis situation, whether it's a termination or a coaching mentoring thing, that they're able to move into that? Or have they just been there the longest? And there's nothing wrong with that, but is that the reason why you made the decision? So let's get real honest about why you made the decision for that staff member, and then does that staff member want it? A lot of times, I'm not sure that that's really the best choice. It could be. It could turn into it for sure. And I think you're right, Jeff. If that person's already in the position, then let's get them some tools and techniques to have them improve. Because what they're really working on is the people stuff. They've got the animal stuff down. They can scale the teeth. They can intubate. They can put catheters in. They can give fluid boluses. But can they pull an employee in the office and have a conversation about something where that employee doesn't feel completely demeaned, but actually feels respected and honored as an employee, and yet the outcome is still achieved of you got to be here on time, or you've got to do this, or whatever. And that does not come from innate human experience. You have to learn that stuff. There's super smart people out there that train people on communication and staying legal in the business side and doing all the things with the right I's dotted and T's crossed. So
yeah, and the reality is being a practice manager is a full-time job, and being a technician is a full-time job. You can't often wear both hats.
No,
you have to have at least a certain amount of your schedule budgeted to that, where you're not on the floor these days and you're strictly doing these jobs. And what I find ultimately happens is, it's a busy day, I have to jump on the floor, and then one of those two areas is
some places is going to suffer.
It's tough. So kind of, I guess along that line, Dave and I were talking about these couple of abstracts that were presented to DiveX at the outset, and I think maybe you saw them, saw the titles of them, but in case anybody else hasn't, the first one is Investigation of Burnout Syndrome and Associated with Job-Related Risk Factors in Vet Techs Working in Specialty Teaching Hospital Settings. And then the second abstract is Investigation of Adverse Care Outcomes, Staff Resources, and Patient Load in the Small Animal ICU. And Dave and I kind of chatted about these a little bit, and the results or the conclusions were, David, you probably can relate to this too. I think, anybody that's done this long enough knows that, yes, when we are overworked and errors are made, and, we're stressed out and all of those things. But from your side now, on management side, does this kind of research help you do your job, or maybe in some ways make it more difficult?
I think that these studies are really highlighting and emphasizing that our teams are so important. And the teams, the people element of veterinary medicine, meaning the staff that work there, they're not widgets, right? They're not robots. And so they have thoughts and feelings and emotions and struggles and challenges and all these great and wonderful things. And so as a manager, I think sometimes it's important to kind of poke your head up out of the numbers and the spreadsheets and just make sure, hey, you know, how are my teams doing? We know some stuff, and I'm not a great study citer on the management side. I don't have enough of that body of literature that I've like memorized, but we do know that most people are not going to come to management for help. You know, you have to actually ask them directly, you know, how has your day been, or what are you struggling with currently? You have to, and those are not the best questions. There's better questions out there, but there's some really good open-ended questions that you can do with your staff and kind of one-on-ones or team meetings. If there's a vibe where people are open in a team, sometimes they're not, to just kind of check in on the pulse of the staff and say, how's it going? And thwart some of these problems before they become what, you know, the study is kind of a prospective study, but they're dealing with a thing when a medical error already happened. So the study wasn't looking at how to prevent them. That would be a different prospective study. But what they found was, you know, that medical errors go up when you have high a technician to patient ratio. So the idea would be, okay, well, let's take that information back and look at our schedules. I think as a manager, especially when you're off the floor, you really rely on your tech managers to do scheduling that makes sense. And so I always tried to work with my technician managers, like to say, look, you know, here's kind of our like labor target, like our budget for how much we kind of need to spend on labor, just to say like, here's kind of like a goal. So we're not super duper overspending and we're watching overtime and all those kind of good things. However, what do you need to run this hospital? You know, like how many staff do you need there? And the technician manager, you know, has to say back to me, I need to hire another person. And I go, okay, let's have a conversation about that. And so I think that knowing this, I think I don't think this kind of stuff ever makes a job easier, because it shouldn't. You know, our jobs should actually always get harder as time goes on and we find out more information and we find out where we're messing up and where we need to, you know, where we need to improve. And so I think in veterinary medicine, you know, we really, especially management, you know, we really have to take care of our teams. You know, we really have to do that, and we have to do it in a good way, in a way that's cost conscious, but also, you know, might need to spend a little money and put some money where the mouth is and take care of those teams. So I think these things are great because you've got these teams that function in such a high level with it's such advanced stuff and skills and stuff that they're doing. And so you can't just say, well, yeah, I'm going to throw a technician in with, as Jeff said in the beginning, 20 patients, knowing that there's this information out there that says, well, actually, the best target is 4-1. So maybe we don't get to 4-1 tomorrow, but maybe we work towards 4-1 over time. And so if somebody were called on the carpet about it, you know, the clinic or the practice or the hospital could say, yeah, we're at 7.2-1, but we're working on it, you know, or yeah, we're at 11-1, but we know and we've got plans in place to work on it, versus, well, I didn't know. Oh, wow. Okay. And that's okay too, but get caught with your pants down, move on, and let's work towards that. So patient care has got to come first. Teams have got to come first. And, you know, if you take care of your team, patient care will follow. Client satisfaction will follow. You know, and you see this with like Virgin and a lot of these other businesses where the focus is on the employees and the team, and they just get amazing results every time. So does it make the job easier? No, but in a good way.
Gotcha. What would be your, or do you have maybe like a go-to or a couple like team building exercises or things that you like to do either like in a staff meeting or that you like to challenge your teams to do?
Oh gosh. So I definitely don't have them like memorized. I definitely do like just Google searches for stuff, okay, but I come up with some good ones. So we did an amazing training at my last practice called, I want to say it was called like the Colors Initiative or something along those lines. And it's a communication workshop where you are given kind of scenarios and adjectives and stuff that kind of describe yourself, you know, kind of like in different ways and how you react to stuff. And then it gets deeper. It's how you as this quote unquote color, and there's blends, but there's this color, react to certain things, interact with certain things, you know, and so it's supposed to teach yourself about why you do certain things you do in different situations, and then show you how to interact with others that are different styles. So it was really interesting. And what's really kind of fun about it is, first of all, when everybody hears their color and their characteristics of that color, they fall off their chairs laughing because they're like, yeah, that's me, you know, and it's like, that's cool. But the deeper level of that, I think, is not just the self-realization, as it is the next layer, which is, oh, when I'm in a situation in conflict, I behave this way. And then the even deeper level is, I could do these things to not necessarily have this color be off-put, you know? So it was fascinating and a really, really interesting exercise. So I've done that, and that's intense, obviously. And then the other thing that I did, or have done different things, is like, you know, like I bought a bunch of bags of spaghetti and had groups get together, and they had to build spaghetti towers with, I think it was marshmallows and noodle. Yeah.
I've done that.
And you know, everybody finds it hilariously silly, but what I do is I sit back and I watch my teams, and I see, first of all, who gravitates towards each other. And there's often groups where there's, you know, five leaders and they don't get anything done. And there's groups where there's five followers and nothing gets done. And then I find there's groups where there's an overbearing leader and everybody's just going along with them. Or there's a, you know, sometimes that really unique team where there's somebody that just listens to every voice on the team, and that one person that speaks up and says, well, I think we should do it this way. And there's no discounting, and they go, oh, maybe. And they get this awesome structure. So I feel like personally that kind of exercise is really for the employees to just let loose, but for me as a manager to step back and watch my teams work and be analyzing and seeing what personalities I have on a team that then builds my team down the road. So, you know, those are just like a sampling of things that I've done.
Sure.
There's a million of them, but I think that, you know, whenever you do a team building thing, there's got to be a reason and an objective and some sort of kind of outcome versus like, oh, we just, you know, had a pizza party or something.
Yeah,
like,
we just did this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So those are some good, you know, some good ones that those are my go-tos at times. So, yeah.
That's pretty sneaky. I've always done those team building exercises and just assumed that they're all just for us to figure out if we could work as a team, but not thinking that the manager's just sitting there watching us and trying to figure out what kind of personalities he has.
Oh, yes.
You've just let the cat out of the bag there,
bro. I have. Eyes in the sky, Dave. Eyes on the sky. Eyes in the back of my head.
Well, that's great. David, I think we're going to wrap up for today. This has been fantastic. I've learned a lot. Not only about education, but about how managers work, what actually is involved in becoming a CVPM. So this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, you listen, guys. I'm super honored. I appreciate it, and keep up the great work.
Oh, well, we're not done yet, David.
I have one last question for you.
I'm ready. So drum roll.
This is something that we're trying to make be one of our things.
Okay.
So we asked you about your coffee in the beginning, and we're going to ask you a random non-veterinary question.
Okay.
That you have no forebearing knowledge about.
Okay.
And we're trying to get, so our listeners, we want them to send us in these random questions.
Okay.
Right now we've just Googled random interview questions and got some pretty good ones. So our listeners are supposed to be sending us in random questions, and we'll say their names on the podcast if we take their question. So the question for you, David, is you are hosting a dinner party. Uh-huh. You must invite three famous people.
Uh-huh.
Who would you choose and why?
Ooh, who would I choose and why? Okay, they can be dead or alive. Like, they could be, I mean, anybody kind of thing, or they have to be alive currently.
They could be dead or alive.
All right, cool. So the first one I would invite is actually Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. Mm. I am fascinated with his emotional intelligence. The ability to be resolute and quiet in the face of what I assume is a screaming upset inside at how, you know, how what's going on around him. And so I think that his level of emotional intelligence is fascinating, you know, being able to get stuff done in an environment that was so violent and so upsetting. So that would be number one. Number two, let's see. I think my second one would be President Barack Obama. I would just love to kind of pick his brain about his leadership style think about what makes him tick, and whether you're Democrat or Republican, I think that most of us agree that, you know, that he was charismatic and was a good leader. You know, not necessarily, I mean, you know, you can debate about what was done, but just his leadership style, his ability to make people feel like they were worth something. And so I would definitely want to just kind of hang with him a little bit. I guess the third one would, and it sounds a little crazy, but the third one I think would actually be Steve Jobs. And the reason why is recently, as I've studied, I've done a lot of work researching Apple and a lot of its business practices and different things. I think he would be a fascinating person because I think that he pushed people's buttons in a million different ways, sometimes aggressively, sometimes poignantly. And I think that it would be really interesting to be in his presence. And so I would just, like, as an experiment at a dinner party, just love to be in his presence, to be kind of cut to the core, and also just pick his brain about why, what is the motive, what did he see behind how he acted? Because I, as a highly, highly intelligent person, I'm fairly certain that he operated with a reason why, you know, like, why was he perceived as this the way he was, and why he did things he did. I think it would be interesting. I'm not saying I want to be like him. I think there's a major controversy about who he was and how he treated people, but I think that it would be really interesting because I think he's one of those people that truly just doesn't care what other people think, and in that way is able to really execute a lot of stuff. And so I'm just fascinated by it. So I think those are the three I think that I would pick. I think it'd be a real hoot and holler.
those are great answers, and I think honestly they kind of speak towards your leadership and your administrative style. Yeah. I mean, you picked out three people and you described why, almost like how you could apply what you would get out of that to your job. You know, you didn't pick a celebrity that, you know, you love their movie or their acting or their singing or whatever, you know, you, yeah. So that's really interesting. Well, thank you again so much for taking the time out and stopping by for a cup of coffee today. We really appreciate it. And we were so stoked that you came by the Vet Tech Cafe today.
Thank you so much.
And we wish you all the best. We hope to see you at IVEX next year, if not before.
Thanks,
we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Heck yeah. Keep on keeping on. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, David. Have a good night. Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.